welcome to another episode of the Coastal Drone Podcast. My name is Coastal Kate, and in our last episode, we did a little interview, and it went over so well, we decided to do another. This time, I sat down to catch up with Travis Harvey. He's the Chief Pilot and Director of Operations of AeroVision Canada. He's in my hometown of Halifax, Nova Scotia, so I've always kept an eye on what they're up to out there. The project we chat about was particularly interesting for me, and I think you'll find it interesting too. AeroVision is definitely someone to keep an eye on. I'm on the Unmanned Systems Canada board with their CEO, Trevor Bergman, and they're always up to something cool. So check it out, let me know what you think, and if you want to see more of these interview-style podcasts or more of what we started with. So without further ado, Travis Harvey. So welcome, Travis. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And before we get too far into this, can you tell me a little bit about what it is that AeroVision does?
Yeah, we are a commercial drone operation company based out of Halifax. We tend to target more industrial use cases or utilities, energy, oil and gas. That's our niche, okay. With some mapping and training as well.
Excellent. So what would a typical day at work look like for you as the director of operations?
There is sort of no typical, aside from, I guess, in the off season where it's a little colder and windier where we're flying less. But for the most part, a typical or more desirable day would be heading out on the road, to be honest, and with our gear loaded up, heading to a site to go fly. That would be kind of my ideal day at this time of year, given the weather.
Yeah, things are not totally frozen. So when you're flying, is that like an all day? Would that be an all day thing? Like drive to site, operate the aircraft, come back, or is it kind of like the flights that you're doing? Are they lengthy typically?
It would depend on the project. For example, if we were if it was a long term project, such as wind turbine inspections, That's all day. They operate on those sites from 6 in the morning until sunset, essentially. So those can be long days. If it's a quicker project, it could be a half day where you're only out mapping, a couple hundred acres maybe, and you're up in the air for a couple hours and then back home and dropping the gear off at the shop by mid afternoon. So it kind of can vary depending on what the project is.
It makes sense. And so what types of aircraft would that be that you're operating? Is it mostly multi-rotor, or do you do some fixed wing as well?
Yeah, we have fixed wing. That's kind of been my favorite bird lately, our EBX with the AreaX payload. She's pretty sweet. Although we do have several multi-rotors as well, a handful of I-2s, Inspire 2s, and 210s, and we had 3 Falcon 8s, Intel Falcon 8s, and then, of course, our robust workhorse, the little P-4 Pro. She gets a lot of work too, so it's all over. It depends on what the job is.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's good to have a big fleet like that where you can kind of pick and choose for what makes the most sense for the job at hand.
Definitely.
Excellent. So how did you get to being at a point where you could fly all of those aircraft? Like, where did you get into the RPAS industry and get to where you are now?
I was it was about 2017 when I started with AeroVision. That was my first foot into the industry. Prior to that, it was more of a slow learning hobby. Okay. I was in the Navy for 11 years, and I got out of there and I switched over to AeroVision. And the guys there were generous enough to kind of teach me as I was going, and that was. It was kind of it. It was a They threw me to the wolves, but I learned quick, and that's, I mean, that's the military way of things anyway. So that was nothing new to me. And we operate in a very structured fashion. So again, that was still nothing new to me. And I was just, all I was essentially doing was taking the uniform off and playing with a different kind of technology.
Very cool. I find that that's something that I keep hearing repeatedly is that a lot of the times the success that folks are finding in the RPAS industry comes from taking a skill set that they have competence in already and then just acquiring a new toy or having the RPAS be the new thing that they're bringing into something that they already knew and understand and operate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it helps that, the guys on the team were both comfortable and had a history with working with military folk anyway. And so it was kind of a no-brainer to bring me in, and we all meshed pretty well. And like you said, the rest is history.
That's helpful when everyone gets along too.
Yeah.
So from 2017 to now, what would you say has been the biggest shift that you've seen, the biggest change in the industry over those couple or few years?
The technology itself has really, pardon the pun, taken off. Like it's ramped up as far as the sensor capabilities and the I don't want to use autonomy because that's not what it is, but the tech has gotten really, really good, and it's only getting better. I mean, we're seeing now, the release of the new M300, which is the Cadillac sort of for the newest of the DJI fleet. The tech has really taken a big turn. I mean, when AeroVision started, they were flying, hobby quads, basically bigger ones that were all built in the shop or in their basement, and now they're it's gone past that, but I shouldn't say entirely. There's still a lot of guys in the industry that are still doing self builds, and their gear is very robust and they know it inside and out, which is also very important.
Right. Yeah, to kind of get those niche applications, there is that skill that's still sometimes required if an industrial drone that's kind of mass produced just doesn't quite fit the bill.
Yeah, that's right. And like I said, the new M300, I don't want to boast it too much because it's only still very new and not fully tested up there in the industry, but I feel like they've kind of, they've ticked all the boxes in this craft, and they kind of listened to the industry and the industry users on this one. And I feel like they have done a good job. That's not to say there aren't going to be any hiccups or problems. That goes with anything, with any piece of technology these days. But I'm excited to fly it.
Yeah, maybe learn from some of the challenges that came up with the 210 and corrected those for the 300.
Yeah, I think they very much did.
Yeah, that's good. Glad to hear. It's nice when someone or an organization that's as large as DJI is still, taking in that feedback and making those adjustments based on what the industry is looking for.
Yeah, definitely.
So I know you mentioned the EB being your favorite bird at the time. And there's the initial reason why I reached out to you, because I was talking to the CEO of AeroVision, Trevor, and he was giving me kind of a high level of this flight over Halifax. And being from Halifax originally, I was really keen to see the footage that you had from this job. So can you explain a little bit, dive into a little bit about this flight with the EB and some other aircraft, I understand, that you did over the city of Halifax?
Yeah, that was, it was brought by a company that we often partner with on some projects, and it was in a collaborative project for the Dalhousie University, and because they're so spread out campus-wise across the city, it's difficult for them to get good aerial data, and they wanted to update their existing records with the current status and situation of all the buildings, right down to pebbles on the sidewalk sort of detail. Wow. So in order for us to encompass a large area like that, we decided obviously EV is the way to go, but there's just some rules you need to follow, of course, and some hoops. And the other downfall to the EV, is one of the few downfalls, being that it's a fixed wing and a belly lander. So you need a little bit of space to take off and land. Being in the urban core, there isn't a whole lot of real estate to do that. It's on a soccer field or Citadel Hill, which is what we opted to do. So for those listeners, I guess the Citadel Hill is a big historic property in the center of the city, and it's managed by Parks Canada, which is a federal organization, and they were gracious enough to let us use their property to operate from right at the doorsteps of the entrance to the actual fortress. So that worked out really, really well. It took some planning determining the weather forecast for one, and choosing where we wanted to launch and land, and then of course we also had to achieve our clearances from Shearwater, because that is restricted airspace right there as well.
So that was all of Halifax is in that DND.
Just about, yeah, right on the cusp of it is right where our office is. So we're right there. So it's a pretty big circle. But it's definitely doable, and the folks at Shearwater know us well, so it doesn't take much to get approval unless they have something major going on. And then, of course, there's the two neighboring hospitals right by Citadel Hill as well. So we were, of course, collaborating with them, and they actually collaborate and coordinate with Shearwater Tower as their main. So anything that goes through Shearwater, they're aware of anyway. So it was a good day. It was just shortly before the Christmas holiday, so it was a little chilly, but it was a perfect time because the greenery was gone. There were a few people around, so because they were all away on holidays, and it was ideal. Yeah, it worked really well.
So you were flying the EB over roadways, over buildings, like right over that downtown core of Halifax, because the Citadel's like right smack dab in the middle. And that, so you had permission, obviously Transport Canada permission, because you're advanced certified and flight reviewer and all of that good stuff.
Yes, as is the EB.
Right, for over people. And that has to come from SenseFly, right? Their manufacturer for the over people declaration?
Yes.
Excellent. So we've got pilot certified, drone certified. You've got Shearwater permission. Is that considered the airspace permission, because they're the authority in that area?
Yes, they are. Yep. And then, of course, for to operate from the hill, we had Parks Canada approval as well.
Excellent, Parks Canada. And did you need an SFOC, because it's within the DND airspace, the 3 nautical miles?
Yeah. We have that. That's just a standing national DND SFOC, which they implemented after the new regs last year. I kind of forget that it's that's an extra step that everyone needs to do if they want to get that. I forget some of those things sometimes.
Yeah, because if you're in Halifax, that's just part of your regular operations, but it would be an extra step for most people. So
yeah,
that's great. Like, knowing that, you know, all of those things can seem like barriers, but if you're communicating and you have those relationships and can establish that like history of being safe operators with those organizations, then it is possible to get the ability to fly in parks, which is something that I think everyone just kind of shies away from. But
you do things right, and then you build a rapport with these people and these organizations, and then it also gains trust. And you know, after doing, you know, several dozen of these within the HRM, they tend to know, you call them and they say, okay, yeah, we know you guys. And it's a non-issue.
Excellent.
It goes two ways. And it's just a mutual trust.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And I think, initially for someone that can seem so daunting, but it is, you know, as long as the communication's there, it is something that is possible.
Yeah. No, it's not hard. We did another one downtown, which was pretty fun. It was sort of an emergency call several times after the hurricane. There was a crane collapse on a construction site just off of busy Hub Street downtown, Spring Garden Road. And again, that was a no-brainer, and it was super easy to get coordinated with Shearwater, and the whole block and a half was quarantined off anyway, so we didn't have to worry about flying over people that weren't involved in the operation, because everybody within the fenced in area was. So for those projects, we were able to, we had the F8, the Falcon 8 out there, and we had our Helios up there, and a whole bunch of the back of the P4 was there too. So that was another fun project.
Yeah, I bet. I'm sure people are familiar with the Phantom 4, kind of the general look of that, but you mentioned two other very cool aircraft designs there. Can you describe the Helios and the Falcon 8 a little bit?
Yeah, the Helios 1 is self-enclosed in a cage. It's about 14 inches diameter, and it's fixed to a two-axis sort of roll bar inside the cage, allowing the pilot to fly within confined spaces. It does fly okay outdoors, but it's a little more susceptible to wind, but it is possible. In this case, we flew it, we basically kind of leapfrogged from one building to over to the next building, and we're able to kind of just do a quick inspection in the crane hub where the crane had collapsed, because mm-hmm. they weren't allowing any people up there. So they wanted to see the condition of the crane and all that. But ideally, and originally, that drone was designed for interior inspection cases. We've used it in our offshore projects for oil tank inspections and things like that.
Cool.
The Falcon 8 is a octo. It's kind of a got a V-shaped frame with the camera mounted on the wider end of the V. She's a very robust and wind-resistant drone, that's for sure. And made by Intel with the A7R mounted on for the payload, which is a pretty nice camera. And we've produced some good data with that. With that camera and that drone.
It's interesting the different effects that the wind can have, because the Helios is like just a ball, right? Like it feels like it shouldn't, be tossed around that bad, I guess. But with the Falcon 8, the props are actually quite small, aren't they?
Yeah, for an octo, they are. Yeah, they're probably only, 5 inches from tip to tip. But with 8 of them, in the V shape that they have, it's a pretty neat design, and it's actually capable of still operating if after two motors would fail.
Oh, really?
It would be your console would be alerting you and screaming at you, but it's still doable.
You would be heading back home, but at least you wouldn't be heading straight down.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent. Yeah, I think that's cool. It's great to hear about the different types of drones and kind of the specific use cases, because you can have a workhorse like a Phantom or Mavic or something like that that's mm-hmm. kind of an all around, but then to have these specific tools for specific applications, it's good to see. And
And it goes along with some of the credentials that are associated with the drone. Like, so to get the Falcon 8 offshore for our offshore projects was easier than if we were to say, hey, yeah, we're coming with our Mavic and we're going to go inspect your flare stack.
Right.
It probably would never happen. Right. But with the Tombstone data that comes with the Falcon 8 and the use cases that it's already been can show that it's already been used offshore a whole lot. So it's known in the industry, and that helps, as well as the 210, and I'm sure the 300 will be out there too.
Yeah, it's always funny. Even I showed up to a real estate development shoot out here once, maybe mm-hmm. 8 months ago, and we have the Mavic 2. Mavic 2 Pro, and they're like, that's it? That's what you're getting these photos with? And I was like, just wait.
No, it's still a great camera on those little things, and it's all your image and your appearance, and it I know what you're getting at. Sometimes you show up and you have a Phantom 4 or a Mavic, and you're wondering, oh, are people thinking that I'm just using a toy?
Right.
And it can be a toy, but at the same time, if it's used the right way, it's a tool, and that's kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah, they were definitely happy with the final product, but I think they were expecting like a Matrice 600 or something like that.
Yeah, kind of overkill for things like that. I mean, we have an S1000 that sort of kind of sits in the case now and just kind of collects dust, and there's no need for a super heavy lifter like that anymore with the cameras that are being mounted on these drones these days.
Yeah, that Hasselblad DJI. Like having DJI acquire Hasselblad, I think, really pushed that forward too with their own products.
Yeah, that helps a lot.
Switching gears here a little bit, there's tends to be a bit of misinformation that floats out there in the drone universe. Is there, if you could correct one misconception with the snap of your fingers, is there something that you know specifically it would be?
A misconception. Yeah, I'm not spying in your window. I really
You're not
care.
That important. Just
no,
sorry.
I do not care. And if I wanted to do it, I could do it from really far away and you wouldn't know I was around anyway. So that's one, I guess. And that one actually hasn't been so bad lately, even with the various generations of people. They're coming around to the concept of these tools in the sky, and we're getting less black and less, people shunning them, or they're just getting warmer reception from the general public as a whole. So
yeah,
that's better.
I agree. I think that's fair. It's kind of like when cell phones first started having cameras and everyone was freaking out about the ability for people to take photos all the time. And now it's just like, yeah,
it kind of went away.
Cameras.
Yeah.
You'd be upset if they didn't have a camera.
Yeah, you're expected to have a photo taken of you.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that's a good point. And for the most part, like, it's hard to look in a window. Like, it's, you know, you'd have to have the light set up. And I was even walking around downtown Vancouver not all that long ago, and was noticing a number of telescopes on balconies. And I'm thinking to myself, like, it's not all that common for people to be stargazing downtown. Like, I wonder.
No, and those are far more powerful than a car's zoom capabilities. So, I mean, if anything, you should be worried about those people staring in your window, especially with all the high rises in Vancouver.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What is it looking forward that you're most excited for? Let's say like the next 12 months in the drone industry, what are you stoked on?
I think the development and the evolution of some of the regs is going to be very helpful for the newer people in the scene, whether it's just for fun or for commercial purposes. And along with, you know, the whispering potentials of BV loss and the way that the FAA is approaching it and that the way that TC is approaching it, I think it's I think those are exciting landmarks,
changes.
I guess that could be happening in the next 12. Additionally to that, I guess it would be the continuous push of new tech. We have no idea what's going to come. I mean, I could speculate there's going to be a lot of new autonomous features or that will help people in the commercial side of things as far as, you know, asset management or tracking of assets within the actual drone, which we're seeing already with the M300.
Some like AI bits?
A little bit, yeah. And it's all based on, you know, previous or existing data that's just allowing the drones to be smarter, essentially.
Right. Yeah, that I agree with you there. I think that's going to be, you kind of have this continuous cycle of a spike in technology and then regulation trying to keep up, and then a spike in technology and regulation trying to keep up. But I think we're at a good spot.
And then there's always, Yeah, I think so too. And I think the general outlook of, I guess, the human race after this COVID standstill is going to help people realize that some things are more important than others in the grand scheme of things. So, yeah, I think that's as far
as... It's good that we have this foundation now of visual line of sight. We've got it figured out. We're not going to see changes every 6 months or special use cases or things being done differently in Vancouver than they're being done in Halifax, and can kind of now move forward with beyond visual line of sight and cool new tech and the right attitude from the general population.
Yeah. And actually, what you just said there made me think of like TC has done a good job of, you know, the umbrella of rules federally and nationally. But I think it would be helpful if the different municipalities or the provinces at least would start to get on the same page with certain things, specifically just like city parks. And, you know, you go to one city and they have these rules, and you go to another city in a different province and it's completely different, and that no one's on the same page with what their rules are. And it makes it difficult, especially for, well, the hobbyists for one, but it makes it difficult for people doing it commercially that want to go. And the city park is the only spot that you can take off from, but you can't, or you can. And it's just they need to level it out, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And it's a little bit scary the amount of misinformation that is coming from cities and other areas, other places where they should know, like police forces and such, where I've developed a bit of a reputation on the Board of Unmanned Systems Canada, because we're actively trying to correct some of these things where people are saying you can't fly over our park. And it's like, well, you can't really do that. That's now Canada.
And
there's been a few where it's like, you know, police websites, it's like totally full of misinformation. I'm just like, so I've got this, I'm gonna have to bleep this, but a bit of a shit disturber, reputation now.
Well, somebody needs to police it, because if the police force or the SCP or whoever don't fully know the rules properly, then they need to be retrained or taught properly. So somebody's got to do it, and it's just a matter of it being done right and by the proper people. And from what I see online and a few Facebook groups and other social media groups that I'm in, there's a good number of people out there that are doing a good job, yourself included. And there's a lot of people out there that are not, but believe it that.
Yeah, I think that's a good spot to end that part. But yeah, I agree. It's been interesting to try and guide things in the right direction. I think people are often caught off guard with what they're allowed to do at this point, especially when you get into the micro drone, like SEB 250 gram RPAS. It's like, no, that's allowed. You just don't want to be an idiot about it. Like, you can fly and controlled airspace. Just don't do it off the threshold of a runway. Like,
well, you can, and that opens up a whole other level. Can of worms too, because who is going to know whether your photo was taken,
right?
And especially if you scrub all the data off the picture, whether you flew it with a 600 or a Mavic Mini,
right?
So it's hard to say, and that can always be somebody's argument. If they want to do things illegally, they could say, "Oh no, I flew with a Mini."
Right.
Prove me wrong.
Exactly. Yeah, I'll leave that in Transport Canada's hands. I'm not out there to police your shots, but I will tell you about, if you want to do things right, I can help you with that sort of thing.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, Travis, thanks so much for your time today and for sharing your knowledge and experience, because I think this kind of thing is really valuable to people that are looking to get into the industry or looking at commercializing their hobby, and to know that, you know, someone who hasn't been doing this since they were 4 years old, you know, building model aircraft and and kind of growing up in the industry and seeing that it is still possible to get into it and be really successful with it, I think is really great. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. It was fun.
Any plugging you want to do for AeroVision that I can put in at the end of this thing?
Just our website, I suppose, if they're looking for any inspection work or things that we specialize in. AeroVisionCanada.com is our website, or info@AeroVisionCanada.com is our email.
And you're not just in Halifax, too. You do work throughout Canada.
We do, yeah. Our main office is in Halifax, and we have a business development employee in Ontario and a contract pilot who is practically our full-time pilot out there because we just feed the work to him. And so it's basically us four right now nationally, but we've been from coast to coast on various projects. So
and off the coast as well. We've been
and off the coast, down the States. Trev was in Africa for a project there last year, a year and a half ago. Yeah, so all over.
Very cool. Excellent. I'll make sure to put that in. Thanks again.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Travis. Coming up next time, I have something a little bit different up my sleeve. I want to make sure that folks are able to access a lot of the knowledge resources that are out there that I think are really great. So I'm going to try my hand at recording some of them. So let me know if that's something you'd be interested in. I've got my eyes on the Aeronautical Information Manual next. So until then, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.